At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Good afternoon, my conscious co-creators. Welcome to another edition of the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I am very, very pleased that you are all here with me today. How's the new year starting off for you? A little crazy, isn't it? Hope you caught my show last week with interviewing author David J. Brown. A wonderful interview on psychedelics and the coming AI singularity. Fascinating discussion. If you didn't catch it, I hope you'll go out and check out the replay on talkradio.nyc. Awesome. So before I introduce my guest, of course, we have our blog post that I wrote a couple of years ago. And this one is entitled, "We Seek in Others What We Do Not Give Ourselves." We are often not conscious about why we are drawn to certain people. That attraction comes from a very deep place. There is an energy about the person that draws us in. Why is that? What is it about this other person that we are just naturally pulled towards them? Often, if we look over many different relationships, we find we are always attracted to the same kind of person. We end up being unhappy when over time we realize there are a lot of things that about this person we do not like. So why is it that we connected with them in the first place? The remarkable thing about humans is that we seek what we do not have. Perhaps we are not that confident, so we are attracted to someone confident. Or maybe we feel undeserving, so we find someone who is quite entitled. Ultimately, it comes down to wanting to find someone who loves us, usually because we don't love ourselves enough. We seek someone else to give us the very thing we do not give ourselves. If we don't validate our own emotions, we will want to be with someone who will validate them for us. When we have low self-esteem or low self-worth, we will naturally be drawn to someone whom we feel better about ourselves when we are with them. Whatever it is that we feel we are lacking on a deep level, we will seek out a partner or a lover with that quality. The challenge is always, what happens in the relationship when we don't feel we are getting what we wanted from our partner? This will inevitably happen because someone else cannot give us what we do not give ourselves. For the most important relationship we have is the one with ourselves. And until we get that relationship right, our external relationships will always suffer. So how do we do that? The first step is to look at our past relationships and be brutally honest with ourselves. What were we really wanting from the other person? Review several past relationships and see if there is a pattern. Once we understand what it was we were looking for, then we have to learn how to give it to ourselves. Is it love, recognition, validation, excitement, or maybe passion. Whatever it is, now we have to find a way to give that very same quality to ourselves. How can we love ourselves more, validate ourselves more, recognize ourselves more? When we learn to give ourselves what we have been looking for from someone else, our whole life changes. The quality of our relationships change, and the quality of our life changes as well. Try it for yourself and see the results. Do you know what you have been seeking from others that you have not been giving yourself? Can you find a way to give it to yourself now that you recognize it? So I wrote this a couple of years ago. I believe after working with a client who kind of, you know, was complaining about or bemoaning the fact that they were always attracted to the same kind of person, that they always ended up with some narcissistic like guy, and they couldn't understand why. They didn't quite get what it was that they kept going to the same person that they ultimately would always end up being unhappy with. And so it started me down this road of inquiry about why do we always end up with the same kind of person? And that's when I kind of hit upon, and I mean, it's not an original idea. I can't remember who it was that said it, but I think there was some psychologist or someone. I heard this quote, or I read this quote, that we always seek in others what we do not give ourselves. And I thought, oh, that explains so much. And so that was the inspiration for this blog post, and that, you know, when we look at our relationships, and it's all kinds of relationships, not just intimate partners, it's not just our spouses, it could be any kind of relationship, that we often, and not exclusively, because sometimes we form a relationship with people who are just like us, because there's a certain connection, and then there's a certain relational quality to that relationship. But oftentimes we look for the qualities in others that we wish we had ourselves. So it could be, again, finding a mentor or someone we look up to that we feel we don't have the quality. And so we look to learn from them and be around them and want to absorb, like, you know, how do I get to be like more like this person? And often the funny thing is we actually do have that quality in ourselves. We just don't recognize it, or we don't feel it in our hearts that we have that quality. So, you know, just a small example, like wanting to be with someone who builds us up and makes us feel, you know, like we're special. We all want to feel special. I mean, that's nothing unusual. And sometimes we think we are a little special, but we're afraid for some reason. Maybe we've been told something in the past. Maybe there's some trauma. Maybe there's some fear around really taking it in. So we want to feel special. We think we're special, but we just can't believe it enough. So then we meet somebody who makes us feel so special. And then we're like, oh, I love this person. They make me feel so special. Unfortunately, when we look for that validation outside of ourselves, when we look for that feeling outside of ourselves, it comes with a whole bunch of other stuff, which usually is not what we're looking for. So it doesn't usually work out that well. Yet when we learn to give it to ourselves, when we learn to just feel good about ourselves for who we are, then when we look for someone else, we can accept them for just who they are. And there isn't this need to like get something from them. You see, that's the thing. As long as we're looking to get something from another person, there's this attachment, there's this need. Majority of the time, things, you know, don't work out all that well. But when there's just this, we feel good, and there's this other person, and it feels good to be with them, and they feel good to be with us, and there's just this natural attraction, then it can really be beautiful. But my invitation to you, my loyal listeners, this week is to maybe just take a little bit of time and take a look over the relationships that you've had through your lifetime and see if there's some common pattern. See if there was something that this other person was giving you that you were looking for, that you weren't even aware, you weren't even conscious of the fact that you were looking for it. And ask yourself, huh, I was looking for this quality in this other person. How am I not giving that to myself? And when we can identify what that quality is, and we can work on giving that to ourselves, on doing some practices and some exercises, and you know, if you want to reach out to me at theconsciousconsultant.com, I'm happy to work with you on that. It can really totally change just how life feels to us. So I hope you like this blog post. It's again entitled, We Seek in Others What We Do Not Give Ourselves. And of course, you can always find my blog at talkradio.nyc/blog or on my personally branded website, theconsciousconsultant.com. All right. It is now my extreme pleasure to welcome to the show author and journalist Alan Pierce. Alan is a journalist, broadcaster, former BBC correspondent, and author of several books. He has contributed to numerous publications, including Time Magazine, all the way to the Sunday Times of London. Alan delves into the complexities of the human experience, from the realms of coma and near-death phenomena to the intricacies of the dark web. He aims to inform, challenge, and inspire by inviting his readers to explore the unseen and misunderstood aspects of our digital and psychological landscapes. In his latest book, Coma and the Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious, Alan explores the profound and enigmatic experiences of patients in prolonged deep sedation. It provides a detailed examination of near-death experiences, alternate realities, and the psychological and physical aftermath known as post-intensive care syndrome. Drawing on real-life patient stories and medical insights, Pierce sheds light on what it means to be unconscious and the impact it has on the human mind. And this is what the book looks like. I highly recommend you go out and get it. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Hey, Sam. Boy, you blow my mind. Thank you. My head's so big.
Well, you know, I always like to make my guests feel good, at least in the beginning of the interview. We'll see how it goes throughout the hour.
Yes. Give me a hard time.
Yeah, I'm going to drill you on this one because this is a topic I'm fascinated with. So I'm curious, how did you get interested in researching about comas and near-death experience?
How did I get to write a book about possibly the most boring subject on the planet, people inside coma, really?
Yeah.
try to sell that one. It was COVID. I think like an awful lot of people, my life was totally disrupted. So was my wife's. We were sitting at home watching far too much TV news. And I just started to wonder why, you know, okay, you're sick, you've got COVID. Why are they putting you into a coma? It's like putting them in the deep freeze. I mean, what's actually happening here? I just wanted to know. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm always asking odd questions. So I had a little bit of a look, and I mean, the answer is that it's to put the patient in the most calm, comfortable situation possible to enable the drugs and nature to do their job. Yeah. That's one answer. So you think, oh, okay, sounds good. And then I thought, I'm a journalist, I won't take just the one answer. I just look a little bit further. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even thinking of writing an article. I just, like, curiosity, wanted to fulfill it. Mm-hmm. I found on Facebook coma survivor groups.
Oh.
And rather than having a peaceful, deep sleep, which is how the doctors will describe a coma to a patient's family, they were experiencing all manner of events within coma. Doctors, I'll just quickly say, quick themselves, to dismiss anything people experience within coma as delusional, a form of hallucination or a false memory after the event. I found that the people were experiencing things initially that looked like the near-death experience, the NDE. Now, do you have a false memory of an NDE? Do you hallucinate an NDE, or do you actually have one?
Right.
But it then went deeper than that. An NDE, as I generally understood it at that time, was a beautiful thing. You're in, like, bucolic landscape. Maybe you meet your dead relatives. You never felt happier, that sort of thing. Well, what people were telling me within their comas is as if that one I just described, you've gone to heaven. Many people within coma, who've had those too, many people within coma, the majority I spoke to, were having experiences that more resembled hell. Real terrifying hell, not necessarily a biblical sense with burning and devils and such, but they were in a form of their personal hell. Mm. And then others were having alternate lives. Now, some were having glimpses into other lives. Some of the people I eventually spoke to, this was James, for example, British guy, and he was recounting multiple deaths, like one after another, like he's just reading off a list. And they almost all involved either aircraft or water or a combination of both, like his plane crashing in the sea, over and over and over and over again. Others would tell me that they had an entire life that they somehow were ripped out of and just found themselves in a bed in hospital with COVID and their family, who they didn't recognize, saying, oh, it's so good, you're conscious. And and they're saying a name, you don't even recognize that name. Their life was the one they were having in coma. It was every bit as real as the life we're experiencing here. They get sick in that life, maybe have what appears to be a heart attack or something, and then their eyes open, they're in the hospital ward, but they're not in that life. And they've left behind their, you know, family, wives, husbands, children, all the rest of it. And they can't come to terms to it. And the doctor will tell you, if you ever get to talk to anyone, and that's a rare thing, to be honest, they will tell you that, sorry, pal, that was a false memory. Yeah. But we have some drugs for that. Don't you worry. And that's where we're at. So I was just, like, getting interested. So how did I start this?
Okay,
that was enough to whet my appetite.
All right. Yeah, that's fascinating. That's amazing. Well, let's hold it there for a moment. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, I've got a million questions around this topic for you. So we're really going to dive in deep with this. So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're talking this hour with journalist and author Alan Pierce, author of the new book, Coma and Near-Death Experience. And we'll be right back in just a moment.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a high-achieving, growth-oriented leader? Are you interested in developing your authentic leadership while creating a healthy, inclusive workplace? Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Bronku, host of The Hard Skills on talkradio.nyc at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, where we discuss how leaders develop the hard skills needed to make a greater impact. We interview experts, have live coaching, and tackle these challenges. Listen to The Hard Skills on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
And welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I see loyal listener Patty checking in on YouTube. Thank you, Patty. I really appreciate you tuning in every week. We are speaking this hour with Alan Pierce, author of the book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. And we're just getting into why is it a dangerous world. So I'm curious, you said that people in coma can experience like almost an entire lifetime while they're in the coma.
Yeah.
Does it make a difference how long they were in the coma as to like how it unfolded? No. Like are people in short comas having short experiences, long comas, long experiences, or no?
Concept of time just goes. Mm. I mean, for example, I'll give you Nick who helped us with the book. He had a clear memory run of 20 odd years. He remembered his childhood, but his last 20 odd years were super clear in his mind. They appeared to be set in the 1960s and 70s. Huh. 20 years. During that time, he had a variety of partners, a whole bunch of different jobs. He got called up for the US Army and did a tour of duty in a Southeast Asian country. And he was in his coma for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Now, he came out of it really well. His partner, his girlfriend, was just fantastic, really kind and helpful. Other people, you try and tell them this, and they just think you're balmy. Wow. One guy who's not in the book, who he wanted to talk desperately, he had a whole other life, different wife. He had three daughters. He was an architect. And then he wakes up in this world and he just can't come to terms with it. And they're like, supposedly he must have loved his wife in the past, but to him, his wife here is a complete and utter stranger. He wants to know where his daughters are, where his real wife is. And he couldn't tell me because he kept breaking down in tears. Wow. Now, the docs have given him medication for this, but I mean, come on. No one talks to people who come out of comas. And just guides them through the process. For example, right. I mean, a former coma survivor who's been through this could actually talk to a new coma survivor and help guide them through this process. But because doctors are stuck in the physical world, you know, these must be hallucinations, it's delirium, mm-hmm. it's false memory, right? It's a form of mental illness. They cannot take themselves into the transcendental realms. You know, I hesitate to say spiritual, but in many ways, these things are spiritual. But doctors won't go there.
Were you a spiritual person before you wrote the book?
No, not at all. I'm a journalist. I used to cover wars and disasters. My feeling about death was death would be precisely as it was before I was born, one big nothing. And when I saw, you know, in the course of my duties, people dead and dying and so forth, it seemed to me that that was the end of their life. Well, I had a complete flip. I mean, I was halfway through writing this book, and I'm talking to all sorts of people now. I'm talking to people who've died, and I mean died in the clinical sense, and been brought back, and the things they're telling me. And not just one, but many. And whilst they're all different stories, they're still all in the same ballpark. And there's no way these people made it up. They're just, and many of the people helping me with the book are connected to the medical world in one way or another. And they've been through, which is one of the reasons they want to talk about it. So my daughter died halfway through writing this book, Rebecca. She was a police detective. Any parent is going to hit you. It hit me exactly as it would hit any parent. However, at the same time, I had this other feeling. I sort of knew that you don't die now. Whereas I mean, for me, this was a complete and utter flip because, as I say, I thought dead meant dead. And now I realize my whole mindset has changed without my even noticing it. And it's done so because of the research I've been doing. So in many ways, I think to me, I think that the book demonstrates that life continues after death. I mean, that's assuming you accept eyewitness accounts, because the book is full of eyewitness accounts, people who have died, who've been at the brink of this life and the next, and they've managed to come back. And their stories, as I say, what's all different, are in the same ballpark. You know, they're meeting dead relatives who are in a different landscape, and so on and so forth. They're feeling at one with the universe. They're seeing colours that they don't even know. They're seeing total beauty, and they're just blown away. And when they come back to this world, if you're lucky like Nick, who had a beautiful, helpful partner who helped him, you know, come back into this, you could take some of these experiences as being utterly life-changing. But unlike having a near-death experience where you might get to talk to somebody else about that because there's plenty online, no one gets to talk, and they keep it to themselves.
Right.
I mean, I spoke to, I don't know how many, but let's say around about 100 coma survivors in the course of this book.
Mm-hmm.
20 full-on were helping me with the book.
Mm-hmm.
Two of those 20 didn't say that they thought they'd gone mad. The other 18 were convinced they had gone insane.
Wow.
Because the doctors didn't help them. Because the doctors are saying, well, I'm sorry, you know, this is a form of delusion.
So a quick question. So you're in this, you're in a coma, you're having this experience of a whole different life, but not necessarily a past life, because it sounds like from what you said, it could be a life that they were still alive in this lifetime when they're having it.
Don't know. I mean, if you take Nick, I mean, he could have easily died in the late 1970s and been born again and been the 35-year-old guy he was, you know, I was speaking to him. No one that I spoke to has had a life in the future. Oftentimes they're even further back. One guy told me he looked really good in a Georgian wig.
So you have this life. You come back. You don't recognize your wife, your children, or whatever. Does their current memories of their current life eventually come back, or over time, or
they tell me that they have memories of their current life because they've been told these memories. One person told me that when she came to, she didn't know what humans were. Her mother's in the room. She didn't know her from anyone. And others have just told me that basically I know what I know because I've been told. You know, I went to my grandson's birthday party on Saturday. I couldn't remember his name. That kind of thing. Yeah. And also when you come out of a coma, having been in a prolonged coma can cause all sorts of physical and mental damage. Tens of points can be knocked off the IQ. People are left in terrible physical damage. Bones calcify, muscles completely waste, and so on. I could go on. It's just absolutely ghastly. And what I'm saying here, you know, I'm giving you examples of alternate lives or nightmarish worlds. Not everyone has that. You know, some people it is a total and utter blank. Other people I spoke to, it's kind of blank, but they're a brain, a consciousness in the complete dark. There's nothing around them. They're just there. One girl, and I say girl because she was 14 at the time, Chiara from Italy, she kept calling out, "Mummy, mummy, come and wake me up. I've been sleeping too long." And she just could not pull herself out of this terrible, terrible black zone that she was in.
Ooh.
It's different for so many people. Others remember nothing. Others remember that.
And there's sort of no correlation between someone who has that complete dark experience versus someone who remembers something. It's not a different type of drug, a different length of time. Wow.
I mean, so some people, one guy, Rory, who helped me, he was in an horrific home invasion. He was at death's door, got airlifted direct to surgery. He had the most horrendous coma experiences, which he said were far worse than the home invasion. And then there's other people, top of my head, Nikki, who's in the book, English woman. Just a normal life, recently married, Everything's going well, got a good job, very happy, got lots of friends. She has the worst nightmarish experience. She spent 80 years as a living mannequin in a serial killer themed bar, where nightly, in front of a paying audience, they would reenact various crimes against her, right? And this went on for 80 years. And she could count the time. She gave birth twice during this, and they took her kids away. And when she came out of the coma, who can you talk to? Who can you talk to about that? And oftentimes, you know, when there's 20-plus people who helped me with the book, it's not like day one they come and tell me these things. After a period of time, and I'm telling them what I'm finding out, what doctors are telling me, and we're having general chats, and bit by bit, the stuff will come out. And they're telling me things, just like Nikki's story of being in the serial killer bar. Sorry, Debbie's story. She'd never told anyone.
Right.
And you couldn't. Right. I mean, you couldn't, could you?
Right, because people just think you're crazy, right?
Yeah. So they're trapped. They come out of it. They've survived something ghastly like COVID. The physical wreck, the brain's often shot to ribbons. And they've got these memories that are so real. And people say, oh, well, you must have had terrible dreams in your coma. You can't dream in a coma, by the way, because your brain's been switched off. You don't go through your circadian rhythms. You do not experience REM sleep. You can't dream. So what the heck? And I've dreamt. I have really, really vivid dreams. I occasionally have lucid dreaming, not on this scale. When they describe things, they're describing exactly.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
As you would describe, say, you know, any event to me in real terms, you know, with the sights, the smells, the touch, the feelings, the emotions, they're real.
Wow. Oh my God. It's amazing. You think of coma, you think of someone just checked out and they go to sleep and they wake up and like, they don't even know the difference, but this is like the real truth is that there's, now, not everybody, but there's a possibility of having a whole variety of different experiences.
Yeah. And no one will even preempt this by saying, hardly ever anyone gets told they're being placed into a coma. They say, can have a nice little sleep now.
Right.
What they should do, which, and then we could get into why they should do it and why they shouldn't put people in the comas. But what they should do is say, look, you're going to go down. You may have some funny experiences. Mm. They're all in your mind. Don't take them too seriously. And you kind of prep people for it. So the horror show that's about to unfold, they may have in the back of their mind, it's not real, and they're survived it. Right? Or when they come out of it, don't just leave them there. And they can't talk often if they've been on a ventilator because they've got damage to vocal cords. They can't speak for weeks in many cases. So it's a lot. They can't actually say to anyone, where's my wife? Where are my three daughters? Yeah, what's happened to my architecture business?
Right. Got it. All right. We got to take a break. We have another comment from our loyal listener, Padney. I'll get to it when we come back. This is such a fascinating topic, Alan. I'm really, really glad you wrote a book and did this research. Okay. So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're talking with Alan Pierce, co-author, I should say. He wrote it with his wife, Beverly Pierce, Coma and Near-Death Experience. And we will be right back in just a moment.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host the program Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I'm Linda Marsanico. The A-Train to Sedona is a memoir about my journey to love and compassion. It's also the name of my new broadcast on Wednesdays at 12 noon. When we are spiritual, we embrace possibilities and ideas, which strengthen our mind, body, spirit, health, and wisdom. On the A-Train to Sedona broadcast, I plan to interview guests who embrace these expansive practices. Join us on Wednesdays at 12 noon on Talk Radio New York City.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
So, Alan, we were talking about how, like, when you get put into a coma, there's usually some emergency. That's why they put you in a coma. And so there's no preparation for it. You're just in it. And then you come out and you don't have anyone you can really talk to about it because everyone's going to think you're crazy. And you've done some research and you talked about how coma is like so bad on the body, it could be bad for the brain. So why do doctors put people in coma? Like is there any alternative to it?
Yeah, really. I mean, this is a large part of the book. If you think the medical history is just littered with examples of things they got wrong, you know, like draining blood from people at death's door, for example. They did that for well over 1,000 years. You could just go on. Not washing your hands. Doctors appalled by the notion they should wash their hands. That was just less than 200 years ago.
Yeah.
They got into the notion of placing people into comas because there were other patients who had a thing called ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome. It's invariably fatal. So to make them as comfortable as possible, they realized when they had these new ventilators that turned up on the market, that microprocessor controlled, that you could just knock them out. And they just looked like all sleeping and comfortable. And eventually they quietly die. So they thought, that's really humane. So when things happen, we can fast forward a bit to COVID. COVID overwhelmed people to such an extent. They'd never seen the like of it before, regardless of what people believe about COVID or whatnot. The medical people were massively overwhelmed and they had no notion what to do. And they thought, ARDS patients. And here's the other thing. They were so overwhelmed that people were drafted into intensive care from all over the hospital system, pediatrics or obstetrics, whatever. And they had no notion about these things. So somewhere along the line, they thought, if we knock them out, they'd be comfortable. And it's a little bit like shoving them in the freezer, as in, we can't go with it now. Let's put them in the freezer, get them out later, see how they are. That sounds a bit glib, but we're not far off the mark there.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I wrote the book, I'm a journo. My wife's a private eye. So we tried to find, my wife B can find anything. Right? We tried to find documentation, medical journals, scientific literature that advocated prolonged deep sedation. There is none.
Wow.
Right? The medical journal, The Lancet, right, is the journal. We spoke to the editors and we said, can you point us to any articles advocating prolonged deep sedation? Took a while, came back. No, we haven't got any. There's a wealth of literature saying, don't do it. Don't do it because physically, you'll cause a massive, massive damage. Your joints will calcify, your muscles will waste, all sorts of terrible things will happen to you. Cognitively, you can be a complete and utter mess, not remembering anything, if at all. Mm-hmm. I've spoke to doctors who do not place people in coma, people who've got precisely the same problems, COVID, whatever, pneumonia, whatever. And they talk to them and they say, the literature is very clear about this. If we keep you conscious, you're invested in your own recovery. You're not knocked out. Right? Mm. Okay, it's uncomfortable. We sedate you, knock you out for a bit, and then you just come to it. It's in your throat. You know it's going to be there, and hopefully you have a partner holding your hand, and gently, 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 you're into it. In the same way, during the period that we've been speaking, we've not given one second's thought to our breathing. Right? Mm. Well, that patient sooner or later will be so distracted they won't give a minute's thought to their breathing. Mm. And modern ventilators allow the patient to initiate the breathing. So actually it's uncomfortable, no joke, but you're in intensive care. That's not fun either. Mm. Right? But you can, and you can run a business off your laptop. You can text your friends and family. Mm. And by being conscious, you're not going into this, even if you're just slightly bubbling under the surface, your conscious world and your dream world will weld themselves into each other. Mm. And those will turn into nightmarish events. It's just horrible for people. People who, for example, it's called prisoner's cinema. People in solitary confinement, when they've got four bare walls, after a very short period of time, and we're talking less than an hour, start to see things in their room. The longer they're in that situation, the more complex things they will see. There's a whole bunch of other people, cities, towns, streets, cars, all sorts. Right? The same thing is happening because the brain is not being sufficiently occupied. That's happening to a lot of people in intensive care who are not even placed into a coma. They're just kind of doped up a bit. That's happening a lot. And that's not appreciated because that's horrifying for people. Yeah. Absolutely horrifying.
A quick question.
Some of it's worth doing.
Yeah.
Can I just say this thing? We've all been in a coma if we've had an operation. You know, if you've had your appendix out and they knocked you out, gave you a general anesthetic, you were rendered comatose. Now, take a heart bypass. It takes between 4 to 6 hours. They know that will cause cognitive harm, particularly if you're young or elderly, but it will cause cognitive harm. People are never the same again. They know this from 4 to 6 hours. The drugs they give you on the operating table are, depending on availability, more or less the same drugs they're giving you during coma, except possibly they're upping things like the benzos and the morphine and so on and so forth. Mm. Now, they know with 4 to 6 hours it causes harm, cognitive harm. People in comas for months, 3 months, whatever. Right? You come out of that, you're fried. You've not slept. Yeah. There's no sleep going on at all. Mm. Your brain is just fried. But it's not appreciated. And when it is appreciated, for example, you know, I like the notion that doctors experiment on themselves, you know, inject themselves with, you know, whatever. I don't know any doctors have thought, coma, I'm going to have to go in and find out what it's like for myself. Now, those that have had an accident, there's Dr. Eben Alexander, who's a neurosurgeon from somewhere in the south of the States. He got a form of meningitis that's invariably lethal. He went into a coma. He just had the full-on near-death experience, bucolic landscape, you know, beautiful music, you know, one with the universe, all of the rest of it. And he's a neurosurgeon. He comes out, starts telling people about this and think he's a nutter. They just think he's nuts. He has, however, written a number of best-selling books, and he's laughing at his former colleagues. However, his former colleagues did not take him seriously. Why didn't they take him seriously? He had to study for a minimum of 14 years over and above becoming a doctor just to be a neurosurgeon. Come on, take this guy seriously. And they don't. They just don't, because they go, ooh.
Yeah,
they One of the people helping us, she works in intensive care. She had the most terrible, terrible time when she was in an organ transplant facility in her coma, and they were just taking her organs out and regrowing them over and over again. Mm. When she came out and she got back to the hospital and she spoke to her colleagues, the doctors, the anaesthetists, and told them about the experiences she had within her coma, they just went, whoa, no way. She's not right. People won't listen, but it's happening. Wow. And it needs to stop. As I said just now, you know, there's a handful of cases really when people can be placed into comas, but for very short periods of time, not for lengthy durations, you know, maximum 24 hours or so. I'm not a doctor, but you can't find any medical literature saying prolonged deep sedation.
Yeah, it's that it's actually a good thing. Wow. Our loyal listener, Patty, asks, and this is around for people who've been in prolonged coma and they have all these memories and things and they come back and nothing is familiar to them. Does it ever lead people to kill themselves? Like is the waking up into this reality and the difference?
Yeah, I guess it does. I mean, I wouldn't know for sure, because if they'd done so, I wouldn't have gotten to talk to them.
Talk to them, right.
Many
right.
people did say to me, I just wish I'd died then. I wish I hadn't come back. You know, the guy with the three daughters, you know, yeah. I just wish I hadn't, you know, he just wanted to stay there, you know, whether they want to kill themselves. Here's the other thing. A large number of the people, particularly those who had some kind of like another life or something on the more positive side, mm-hmm. have come back with no fear of death. In fact, you know, I know exactly where I'm going. But I'm in no hurry. That kind of attitude.
Right.
There are others, like Rory, who was in the home invasion, who's just petrified of death. Yeah. He thought his world, I mean, he was just trapped in this weird glass bubble, and he was sold as a sex slave, and all sorts of terrible things happened to him. And he thinks that's what awaits him when he dies. Others who met their dead relatives was standing on the threshold but couldn't put a foot over, know that awaits them when they die. Mm. And that's in the book. That's people I've spoken to, people just opening up. And people are telling their stories, not because they want self-publicity, although they all know, everyone's using their real name. They're doing it because they want other people who've been through this experience to know that they're not alone. I mean, this is key. And if you know anyone, if you're listening to this and you know anyone who's been in a coma, point them in the direction of this book, because suddenly that, you know, some of the people that contacted me since the book, again, I thought I'd gone insane. I thought it was just me. Thank you. And I think if one person does that, and we've had that one already, that's enough, you know, it makes the book worthwhile. And I'm hoping like an awful lot of people. In COVID, globally, it's hard to say how many were placed into comas, but we're talking in the millions.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now,
that is mind-boggling.
A percentage of those will be having the experiences we've been talking about today, and they've got no one to talk to about them. You know, you're lucky like Nick, who's got a really wonderful partner, and she's just so understanding, and he can just open up. That's fine. Others just sit there on the sofa at home, like, can't tell their wife, and you're thinking, I'm supposed to have fallen in love with this person? I don't even know who she is. She's got some funny habits. And before this, they were in love, you know?
Yeah.
It just changes everything.
Wow. Truly amazing. All right, we got to take our last break of the show. When we come back, you kind of touched upon it already, but like, what is the impact you're hoping to have with this book? And who is this book really written for? Okay.
Okay.
So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We've been speaking this hour to Alan Pierce, author of the book, Coma and Near-Death Experience. And we'll be right back to wrap it all up in just a moment.
Were you an essential worker during the pandemic? If you needed to learn stages of epilepsy, did you depend on advocates? Did you use new innovations to cope with mental and neurological issues? Maintaining high quality of life and keeping good mental health are what we all strive for. I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each week, top healthcare influencers, professionals, and innovators answer these questions and more. Stay tuned on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will continue to be Frank About Health with all of you.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant. And on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
So, Alan, you initially started investigating for your book on coma and near-death experience because of COVID and what was happening and so many people being placed into coma because of it. I mean, now the book is written and it's published and it's out there. Who do you feel this book is really for? I mean, is this for people who've been in a coma to help normalize thing? Is this for medical professionals? Is this just for anybody interested in the topic? Who's it really geared towards?
Okay. All of the above.
Okay.
You know, I really, really want coma survivors to read this book because if they've had any kind of guidance or whatever from the hospital afterwards, it's been nonsense. I mean, this comes straight to the point here. They've been told nonsense. The book will put everything in perspective, absolutely everything in perspective. And it's not just my thoughts on things. I mean, everything has been checked and checked and checked again. I had, like, Vanderbilt Medical School, right? They have fact checked the book. Right? So we are really clear about all of this. Medical people, boy, do I want medical people to do this. People tend to practice experience-based medicine, as is. We've always done this. This is what my supervisor says to do. We will do this until we see a problem, as opposed to evidence-based medicine. Keeping abreast of all evidence is a full-time job. So it's not everyone's up to doing that. When you have experienced medicine and you treat this person and they eventually become conscious and you move them down, if they do, and you move them down the line to a care facility, it's ages before they speak again. You never get to speak to that patient. It is exceptionally rare. It's a bit like working on a conveyor belt, because critical care has become a conveyor belt of care modern times. Yeah. Like working on a conveyor belt and not looking over your shoulder at the end product, because it's coming out wrong. Right. Yeah. So I really want doctors and nurses to wake up to it. People who are coming new to the profession are seeing the new literature, but they're entering hospital systems where they go, oh, no, no, we don't deal with that. We just conk them out, give them a nice sleep. They'll be fine. Yeah? And then they get trapped in this world. So I want that to happen. But everyone should read this book. Statistically, if you live in the developed world, you're likely to spend 2 to 3 stays in an intensive care unit in your life. I've had one. Now, if you're in a situation where you're in a critical situation, you don't put you into intensive care unless there's something seriously wrong with you.
Right.
Today, it has become the go-to procedure where knock them out, fill them for the meds, see how they get on, try and bring them out, and pass them down the line. Many people die within coma. Statistically, it's actually quite shocking. We do go into that. And another thing that happens when they try to bring people out of a coma, right, oftentimes they're either completely monged and they just can't talk for weeks after the drugs, or they come out kicking and screaming because they're coming directly out of something like an organ harvesting facility or whatever, and they're desperate to cling onto this life, and they're biting and they're fighting and they're ripping all the tubes out of them. First thing the nurse will do is turn the meds back on and send them back down again. So they're spending even longer and they're sending them straight back into this nightmarish world. Now, because statistically, any one of us could have this happen. It could very easily happen to any one of our relatives. You know, they're in an accident, whatever. They've got some kind of, you know, viral disease of the future. The doctors may say, I'm sorry, but the best thing for them is to give them a nice deep sleep. Well, if you've read this book, you'll know that's not the case.
Right.
And hopefully you'll be able to argue about this because, quite frankly, and, you know, there are instances, you know, certain types of abdominal wounds. If you're having a brain seizure, best switch it off so it doesn't cause damage. But we're not talking for 3 months at a time. We're talking for very brief periods. And people agree with that. There's no problem with that. It's the prolonged element, you know, weeks and weeks and months.
You mentioned something before about sort of the similarity between this and when someone is like in solitary confinement in prison and there's no like a sensory deprivation experience. You mentioned to me off camera about this idea of dark retreats and how that relates to some of this. I'm wondering if you would, we just got a couple of minutes, so we just got to keep it brief.
So I'm looking for parallels of the events mm-hmm. that people are telling me that they're experiencing within coma. I've got some Buddhist friends, and they said, you should just look into dark retreats. What's a dark retreat? Since the dawn of time, mystics and gurus have taken themselves off the darkest recesses of caves. You know, they cut themselves off in the physical world so they can commune with the spirit world. Well, mm-hmm. these days you can book this online. Now, I spoke at length with the Hermitage dark retreat in Guatemala. And, oh boy, they've had something like 500 people run through their dark retreat. Wow. And I showed them coma survivor accounts, and they're saying, whoa, this is what people experience within dark retreats. What's a dark retreat? You're in an enclosed dark space. There's absolutely no light. Food is passed through an airlock system twice a day. No contact with the outside world. Within minutes, your brain will start creating images, geometric patterns, all the rest of it. Mm. After time, you will start seeing horrific events like evil creatures crawling towards you and so forth. Mm. Because you're prepped, because you know about dark retreats before you do this, you know to expect these things, and you know that that terrible creature crawling towards you isn't really there. Someone in a coma who's not been prepped thinks that evil creature is crawling towards them. Within these dark retreats, we're talking a room, you know, the size of an average apartment, say, but it's pitch black. It can become the size of a cathedral. It's illuminated, massively illuminated. It's full of people. Sometimes they're in medieval costumes. Sometimes they're wooden figurines. Sometimes you've got flying boats full of kittens flying around, or giant stone spaces, or huge animals. And people are seeing all these things. No drugs except those produced within the human body. And this is one of the key elements. The human body produces DMT, which you've talked about a lot in your show. No one knows quite where we produce it. They certainly don't know why we produce it. But the effects, when you're nearing the end of life, say with a near-death experience, and you compare that with the DMT trials that Strassman undertook, there's massive similarities. And there's remarkable similarities between what people experience in a coma and what people experience within a dark retreat, say, for 40 days, because DMT has been released in their system. It's completely opened their consciousness to other realities. And that's what's happened to people in coma.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. That's incredible. And by the way, Dr. Rick Strassman will be coming on my show in a future episode in a few weeks. So.
Well done. Yes. Hero. Yes. Absolute hero.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to having him on the show. Well, unfortunately, Alan, we have to leave it there. This is such a fascinating topic. And I didn't even get a chance. I wanted to ask you kind of how this all relates to the digital world, because I know that you've also written books on the digital world and stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't. Okay, good. That makes it quick. So thank you again. His book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, available from all major booksellers. Special thanks to Inner Traditions, through whom I got connected to Alan.
Thank you, guys. Yeah.
Thank you so much. One last little question. Just is there any like future book you're working on that's going to be related to this topic, or is it just
no? I'm kind of keen to find different ways of contacting coma survivors, or talking to them, or talking to doctors and nurses. That's really what I need to do next.
Okay.
I can't do a sequel, you know, Coma Near Death Experience 2.
Right.
It just wouldn't work. I want to find ways of getting the message out that you've really got to stop doing this. And if it is happening to you, you're not alone.
Yes. So please, if anyone listening to this show, if you know somebody who's been in a coma, from COVID or for anything, please make sure to get them a copy of this book. Let them know about the book. Again, the title is Coma and Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. Thank you, Alan.
Sam, thank you so much. Been an absolute joy. Enjoyed
myself. It has been. And of course, thank you, my loyal listeners, for tuning in every week. If you missed any part of today's show, again, you can always catch the replay on talkradio.nyc, and you can always catch the podcast on all the major podcasting platforms. Thank you all for tuning in. Take care. We will talk to you all next week.
listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Were you an essential worker during the pandemic? If you needed to learn stages of epilepsy, did you depend on advocates? Did you use new innovations to cope with mental and neurological issues? Maintaining high quality of life and keeping good mental health are what we all strive for. I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each week, top healthcare influencers, professionals, and innovators answer these questions and more. Stay tuned on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will continue to be Frank About Health with all of you.
Hi, I'm Linda Marsanico. The A Train to Sedona is a memoir about my journey to love and compassion. It's also the name of my new broadcast on Wednesdays at 12 noon. When we are spiritual, we embrace possibilities and ideas, which strengthen our mind, body, spirit, health, and wisdom. On the A Train to Sedona broadcast, I plan to interview guests who embrace these expansive practices. Join us on Wednesdays at 12 noon on Talk Radio New York City.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant. And on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a high-achieving, growth-oriented leader? Are you interested in developing your authentic leadership while creating a healthy, inclusive workplace? Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Branku, host of The Hard Skills on talkradio.nyc at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, where we discuss how leaders develop the hard skills needed to make a greater impact. We interview experts, have live coaching, and tackle these challenges. Listen to The Hard Skills on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.